From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. As August marks National Child Support Awareness Month, we explore the economic and social conditions of kids in Florida. WalletHub.com's 2015 Best and Worst States for Underprivileged Children report ranks Florida 45th in the nation overall, considering a variety of factors from access to health care to food insecurity. We'll take a closer look at the findings. Plus, a recent independent report from Florida's Auditor General cites concerns over the security of Florida's voter registration database. Will Florida be ready for the 2016 elections? And as the Federal Voting Rights Act turns 50, we'll explore the history of the civil rights law in the Sunshine State. First, this news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. August 6th marks the 50th anniversary of the Federal Voting Rights Act. We'll explore the history and impact of the law here in Florida. Plus, a recent independent report from Florida's Auditor General cites security risks with the Department of State's voter registration database. Later in today's show, we'll examine how election officials are preparing for the 2016 presidential election. But first, as August marks National Child Support Awareness Month, we focus on the status of kids in need here in Florida. The personal finance website WalletHub.com has released its 2015 Best and Worst States for Underprivileged Children report. Among the 50 states in the District of Columbia, Florida ranked 45th overall, considering a variety of factors, including household income, food insecurity, access to health care, and rates of children in foster care, among others. The Annie E. Casey Foundation's 2015 Kids Count report, released in July, paints a similar picture. That report finds that even as Florida continues to experience positive economic growth, the rates of children living in poverty remains on the rise. Currently, about one in every four children in Florida live in households below the official poverty threshold. That rate is about $23,600 a year for a family with two adults and two children. Joining me now for a closer look at the findings is Jill Gonzalez. She's a spokeswoman for WalletHub.com. Jill, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thanks so much for having me.
And with us in studio is Miriam Pereira. She's Director of Development for the Harry Chapin Food Bank of Southwest Florida. Along with its 150-plus partner agencies, the Harry Chapin Food Bank provides food assistance to some 30,000 people in Southwest Florida each month. Miriam, nice to have you in studio today. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for inviting us to talk about this topic. We appreciate it.
And I invite listeners to join the conversation as well. Connect with our guests with your phone calls to 1-877-428-8255. That's 1-877-GCU-TALK. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Post comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media, or join the live Twitter chat using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. And Jill Gonzalez, let's start with you. First of all, tell us generally about WalletHub.com. What kind of education or services does the organization provide?
Sure. WalletHub is a consumer-geared personal finance site. So not only do we help navigate through a lot of the other personal finance topics, but we put these data-driven studies together to look at some things. For instance, now, underprivileged children. It is Child Support Awareness Month, and millions of dollars in child support go really left unattended annually. So we're kind of taking a deeper dive out of the children that affects.
You know, when looking for data regarding the welfare of children, you know, a personal finance website isn't exactly the first thing that comes to mind, at least for me. Can you just tell me a little bit more about how these kind of reports really fit into the mission of the organization?
Sure. So we're looking at overall the children having a strong chance of growing up to become productive members of society, to give back to the American economy, to give back to the American workforce. And unfortunately, when nutritious food, good education, quality health care, adequate safety, and, of course, support of caring adults is not there, then they can't be those kind of adults who do give back to the American economy and workforce. So that's really the angle that we looked at it. As far as the sources that we used, that was the Annie E. Casey Foundation, as you mentioned, also the Census, the Administration for Children and Families, the CDC, and a few others.
All right. So the data is already out there. You're just sort of looking to mine it and, you know, make sense of it.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, let's just delve right into the findings of the report. As I mentioned, Florida ranked 45th overall. Tell us what some of the different factors were that were used to make those rankings.
Florida did rank 45th overall. A couple places where it fell in the metrics where we looked at the percentage of children in single-parent families. About 40% now of children in Florida are in those types of households. Also, the percentage of maltreated children, so that's any kind of neglect or abuse. Florida ranked 35th there. About 1.2% of children are maltreated. We also looked at the food insecurity rate, which you touched on a little bit earlier. That's at 27% now. Those are the children who either don't know where their next meal is coming from or if it's coming at all. Hmm. And then lastly, and I think this is a topic that's really going to heat up, especially with the debates and the ongoing campaign, the percentage of children that still lack health insurance coverage in Florida. This actually ranked fourth most at 11.3%. So really across the board here, definitely some areas where Florida could use some improvement.
All right. Going back to one of the numbers you had just mentioned before, when it comes to you know kids who are abused or neglected, where do you get that kind of data from? Is that from departments of children and families or something along those lines?
Yes, the Administration for Children and Families.
Okay. And and as you mentioned, with you know the big one being health care, do you think the Florida legislature's decision to not expand Medicaid through the Affordable Care Act had a big part in where Florida fell on that?
I would say absolutely. And we've seen this in other states as well, Mississippi being one of them that ranked lower here on the list, Arizona too. So I think that's definitely something that did affect this, among other things. I mean, not providing that access to health care is a huge part. That comes with enrichment programs, nutritional subsidies for low-income children, too. So there's a lot of moving parts here.
Right. Well, I wanted to get into the rankings on economic factors, such as the rate of children in households living below the poverty level. The official poverty threshold set in 2013 is $23,624 a year in income for a household of two adults and two children. Do you consider that a pretty conservative metric? I would imagine families making even more than that amount would still be struggling to make ends meet from month to month.
Yes, definitely a conservative metric, especially in Florida, where the minimum wages adjusted for cost of living can really, really be harsh on these families. So like you said, one in four children now live in those types of households with below poverty income, which we have to remember, like you said, is a conservative level to begin with.
Right. And, the area where Florida ranked the poorest looked like was in the percentage of children without that was actually health insurance. I was looking at children living in single-parent households. I was just curious as to why that factor was included in the report. Is that considered a major issue regarding child welfare and living in a household with two parents as opposed to one?
It was. So this is something that we found both when we were looking at the Administration for Children and Families past studies and surveys, as well as the Annie E. Casey Foundation. They found that there is a correlation between the percentage of children in single-parent families and then those in households with below poverty income and those who just don't have access to as many resources as those who might be living in two-parent family homes.
Okay. And Florida did rank 45th in that national ranking on the ratio of children living in renter-occupied homes compared to children living in owner-occupied homes. Does that really make much of a difference when it comes to a child's overall well-being? Why was that factor included in the report?
Yes. So this is another correlation that we saw, which is why we included it. But it seems that transient lifestyle, so living in a renter-occupied housing unit, this will differ from state to state. That transient lifestyle has given a lot more instability to some of these children who are underprivileged. So that is something that we did decide to include, and you said Florida ranked 45th here.
All right. As August marks National Child Support Awareness Month, we're exploring the findings of a new national analysis and ranking of states when it comes to the welfare of kids. That's from WalletHub.com. We're speaking with WalletHub spokesperson Jill Gonzalez, along with Miriam Pereira with the Harry Chapin Food Bank of Southwest Florida. Listeners can connect with our guests, add your comments and questions to the conversation by calling 1-877-GCU-TALK. That's 877-428-8255. Send email to GulfCoastLive@WGCU.org or follow the live Twitter chat using the hashtag GulfCoastLive. And, you know, taking a big picture view of the data, do any trends emerge? It seemed like generally the states with lower rankings on these factors of child well-being were in the South, while those at the top of the list tended to be kind of in the New England or Midwest area.
We did see that kind of trend. So the top five here, North Dakota, Connecticut, Minnesota, New Jersey, and New Hampshire, came out as number one. When we look at the opposite side of things, New Mexico, Georgia, Arizona, Mississippi, and actually the District of Columbia here ranked 51st. So, yeah, there are some trends, but there's also some kind of pop-ups of states that really don't fit inside those trends. And I think, really, you know, aside from regional ties, the thing that's going to be important here is how resources are distributed. And that's something that we touched on, how Florida is doing, especially when it comes to healthcare and early educational resources. The same can be said in some of those other states like Mississippi, Arizona, and D.C.
Yeah. Were there any other kind of trends illuminated by this report that you'd want to highlight?
I think one thing, and this is the reason why we wanted to do this in the first place, is looking at some of these trends and how drastic some of the numbers are. Looking back to the U.S. in total, it now has the second highest rate of child poverty among economically developed nations. Only Romania has a higher rate. So that's something that I think we really need to consider and give more of a voice to, especially with the upcoming election. I mean, this is something that's really subsided in what we're talking about, and I think we need to bring it back into the light.
Does this report attempt to identify reasons perhaps why some states are doing significantly better than others, or is it really just about, you know, kind of getting the information out there and letting people, you know, compare one state to another?
More so getting the information out there. Again, this is data that exists, but a lot of people don't know that, one, it exists, or two, how to find it and how to get to it and how to really analyze it. So that was definitely the priority here, but we also had some academics weigh in as to why. And when we're talking about elected officials placing a high priority on the needs of underprivileged children, we realize it's not so much the elected officials, but really what is in place here and how the votes are turning out here for that infrastructure program. So I think that programs really at the community level rather than the state level are what is going to help out underprivileged children the most and hopefully have an effect as far as the data is concerned.
And who are you hoping is really going to see this information? You know, lawmakers, policymakers, child welfare advocates, the general public, parents, or all of the above?
Definitely all of the above. And if it's not getting to the eyes of lawmakers, policymakers, elected officials, that's when the hopefully community, parents, teachers too, who see this, can really kind of take a stand and start advocating more for it, especially when you have numbers like this that just can't be argued with.
We're exploring the welfare of underprivileged children in Florida. The state ranked low in a recent analysis and ranking of states by WalletHub.com. We're speaking with WalletHub's Jill Gonzalez and Miriam Pereira with the Harry Chapin Food Bank. I invite listeners to join the conversation with your comments and questions. Phone lines are open at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Send email to GulfCoastLive@WGCU.org or follow the live Twitter chat using the hashtag GulfCoastLive. And Miriam, I wanted to bring you into the conversation now. Before we delve into the issues of food insecurity, first of all, just give us a little general information on the Harry Chapin Food Bank.
Sure. Thanks again for inviting us. This is our 32nd year of service in Southwest Florida, and we cover the five-county area of Lee, Hendry, Glades, Charlotte, and Collier counties. Our main warehouse is based in the Fort Myers area, and we rent some warehouse space as well down in Naples. We serve about 150, 160 agencies now in the five-county area. And these are organizations that run everything from after-school programs to emergency food pantries, to other types of organizations or programs that support people who need to get food because they just can't afford to get food otherwise. So we distribute food to them. Fresh produce is a big part of what we do now, perishable food, because of the nutritional aspect that involves children and seniors as well. And this past year, we just finished our fiscal year back in June, and we distributed about 18.4 million pounds in the five-county area.
Wow.
To give you an idea, before the recession hit, we were at 3 to 4 million. So that gives you an idea as to how much it's increased. And of the 30,000 people that we estimate that we serve through this partner agency network, roughly 40% of them are children.
Wow.
So you're talking roughly 12,000 children a month in one form or another are receiving food that we receive through donations to these different programs. And we started the mobile food pantry program down in Collier a few years ago, in part through the Naples Children and Education Foundation with a grant that we received through them. And that's the organization that helps organize the wine festival in Naples because of the need. The foundation's charter, if you will, was to help support children in some way. And part of that was food. If kids don't eat proper food, specifically fresh fruits and vegetables. Yeah, your mom was right. Eat your broccoli. If you don't eat fresh fruits and vegetables and you go to school on an empty stomach, you're not going to do well. Food is the top of mind. Learning is the last thing on your mind. And that has ripple effects throughout a child's life. So our goal is to help feed those in need. And many of them, in our case, are children. I was just looking at some statistics. I was doing some research for this program, and the food bank is affiliated with Feeding America, which is based in Chicago. Mm-hmm. It's a national organization that deals specifically with food insecurity, and it has come out with several reports on food insecurity involving different segments of the population. And it looked at this report is called "Map the Meal Gap," and it looked at all of the counties in Florida. Total population that is insecure, food insecure, and population specific for children that is food insecure. Just to give you an idea, Hendry County, in terms of child food insecurity, was 30%. Glades County was the highest in the state of Florida at 33.4%. Collier was 24.5%. Charlotte was 26%. And Lee County was almost 26% of the child population in those counties are food insecure. So, yes, this is a concern, and we try to deal with it as best we can every day with the agencies we collaborate with.
Miriam, I have to say that the growing rates of need is kind of perplexing. It's almost it's sort of counterintuitive. You would expect need to go up in the recession when folks were losing their homes, losing their jobs, and then as the economy has improved, that the need would go down, but that hasn't happened.
It hasn't really happened. The economy is improving, but there's this economic principle, and I am by no means an economist. The first hurt and the last to recover from a recession are low-income people. And we're seeing, yes, they may have jobs now versus pre-recession or during the recession, but it's not the same kind of job that they had 6, 7, 8 years ago. They may not be making the same amount of money that they were then. They may have 2 or 3 jobs, and it's oftentimes a choice of, do I pay off my rent, pay off my other bills, or do I put food on the table? And you've heard me say this before. And oftentimes it's the food that suffers in that equation. Mm. And the need maybe has tapered off, but it's still at a much higher level than it was during the recession. And we don't see that changing anytime in the near future.
I would imagine the summer months are a particular challenge for you and your partner agencies. For a number of reasons. Number one, the agreements that you have with local growers, well, it's summertime. They're not really producing a whole lot right now. Kids are out of school where in some instances they might be getting a free or reduced price meal, and that's not happening anymore.
Right, exactly. So for the summer for us, what we do is we focus on things like the mobile pantry program. So we'll work on summer mobile pantries with different organizations throughout the area, and that's dependent on funding as well. So we rely on private donations to help support that program. Also, it's like everything else in Southwest Florida, it's very seasonal. As you pointed out, during the summer, we have to go out of state, out of the area to find that fresh produce and to bring it into state, and it's very expensive. Then when growing season is in full swing, we rely on regional growers, local growers who support us, and the Florida Association of Food Banks, which works with all of the member organizations, all of the food bank all of the various food banks in the state of Florida, to also work with other growers to help us get that produce in the door. And they are also very much proponents of child nutrition and the link between produce and fresh food and how that affects a child as well. So, yeah, you're right. It's very difficult. If you had come to our warehouse 3 or 4 months ago, you would have seen a lot more food in there. And you go in there today and, yeah, we still have some, but it's nowhere near as the level it should have been or it was a few months ago. And it'll probably be that way. It'll taper off even more between now and probably October, November when Thanksgiving's around the corner. And that's what we have to grapple with every year.
Well, so as seasonal residents return, you get more donations, more volunteers.
Right, and that's wonderful, and we really appreciate that. And then people are very much in a charitable mood at that point because right. It's the holidays. But something that we say at the food bank is that hunger isn't seasonal. It's there right. throughout the year. So that's why, especially during the summer, we have to rely on community food drives to a larger extent, and then going outside of the area to find that food that we need to get to those kids and to those seniors and everybody else who's in need in this community.
And, you know, I know we have data on, you know, how many kids are helped by the food bank mm-hmm. and its partner agencies, but I imagine it's a tougher challenge to actually, you know, really enumerate how many kids are food insecure. I mean, if you go to bed hungry the night before because your family couldn't afford to provide a meal, you're not exactly going to – or necessarily going to be like self-reporting that.
Right. There's the stigma involved. Yeah. People are embarrassed or ashamed that they can't feed their kids. And trying to explain food insecurity and hunger is not an easy task because – you think of the image, when you think of hunger, you're thinking of the images that you see on those infomercials on television. Mm-hmm. Child with a distended belly, that's starvation. That's different. And thankfully, that's not an issue in our community. For us, it's literally you go into someone's house and their refrigerator is empty or their cupboards are empty. And it's not because, oh, I just haven't had a chance to go to the grocery store. It's a chronic issue. It's week to week and month to month that it's like that. And these are kids who probably sit next to your child in school or are in the daycare with your child. And they look like you and me. And that's why it's so difficult for some people to understand. And it's difficult as well because so many of them do have jobs. Yeah. They're just in the service industries. And, you know, they're grappling with the more cost of living, higher cost of just more expenses.
Well, anybody working in the service-based industry this time of year is just struggling because it's the off season.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then, you know, you're laid off for a couple months because it is the off season. So then what do you do for those 2 or 3 months?
Yeah. Well, the news press recently reported that due to participation in a federal food program that the Lee County School District is going to see an increase this year of about 16,000 students receiving free meals at school, and that all students attending 71 different school sites in the district are going to receive free meals. Mm-hmm. Do you think that could perhaps help take some of the pressure off you guys?
During the school year, absolutely. And I think the statistic is something like 2/3 of the children in the Southwest Florida area who attend public schools are either eligible for a free or reduced meal or actually receive it. And when school is in session, that's when that program really helps. When it's out of session in the summer, that's when the issue really strikes home. And then what about the weekends?
Right.
You know, what do you do then?
Let's take a call from Don in Naples. Don, welcome to Gulf Coast Live. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. I'm from Naples. I'm originally from Iowa, but I always try to simplify everything. And to me, Florida's a fair weather state, you know, and they need people. They open the doors. But when people need social programs, they're closed down or they never open up because they really would, I think, prefer just people just to go away. You know, come back when we need you. But if you're in need, just go someplace else.
All right. Well, Don, thank you so much for the observation here. I think that ties into a bit about what we've been talking about today. You know, and I think you touched on this a little bit already, but, you know, as we consider food insecurity, you know, within the context of all these other factors in the Wallet Hub report, like healthcare and education, are they inextricably linked? You made that good analogy about a kid in school. It doesn't matter how good the school is. If he's hungry, he's not learning.
Yeah, I think there is a valid point to that because we see that study after study shows that there is a direct link between something as basic as a nutritious meal, as nutritious food. It fuels your body. You need that to be able to function on a daily basis. Imagine if you don't have breakfast, lunch, or dinner one day. If you just fast for one day, how competent are you?
Yeah, I'm not going to be very productive. No,
you and me both. Yeah. So imagine if you're 5, 6, 7 years old, and it's the first day of school. You haven't had a nutritious meal, you know, maybe over the weekend or maybe 1 or 2 days, and then you're sitting there and you're expected to start learning how to count the colors, your ABCs. How effective are you going to be? And we have heard from teachers and parents and people who are touched by the education system locally in one way or another, who have seen kids go to school and they ask their teachers, do you have something that I can eat? Can I take something home with me to either feed myself or feed my brother or my sister? And it's anecdotal, but it's concrete proof that, yes, there is an issue. And you go to one of our mobile pantries, and I have seen it time and again. A mom in her uniform goes to a mobile pantry. She's off her shift from work, and she's got her little ones in tow. And you give these children a loaf of bread or a bag of produce, and it's like you're giving them $100.
Right. Wow. Well, we are about out of time for this segment, but Jill Gonzalez, I wanted to give you the final word.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks, Miriam, for everything you said. I think the really important thing here is that it does come down to that nutritious meal at the end of the day, and it is interlinked with the education that these children are basically able to get. And I think that America really needs to focus on basically giving these children the same shot at the American dream that a lot of other children do have. And if it comes back to, yes, affordable childcare, but also affordable housing, that's another point of focus that we really need to look at.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. That was Jill Gonzalez, spokesperson for WalletHub.com. The personal finance website's Best and Worst States for Underprivileged Children report is available online. You can find a link to the report at our website, wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. And Miriam Pereira is the director of development for the Harry Chapin Food Bank of Southwest Florida. Again, thank you both for being with us.
Thank you again.
Thanks.
We're taking a short break, but when we return, the Federal Voting Rights Act turned 50 last week. We'll explore the history and impact of the federal civil rights law here in Florida, and we'll explore recent concerns over the security of the state's voter registration database and how election officials are preparing for next year's presidential election. That conversation's just ahead. Stay with us. You're listening to Gulf Coast Live on WGCU, NPR for Southwest Florida.